listen to that. It started already. Hurry up, would you? That's a mighty tune. Welcome to this, the third episode of ICR Headland New Media's production of Rambling House. As usual, we have the Rambling reporters Tony McLaughlin and JP Bradley here with us. Well, Tony, how did things go last week?
Well, PJ, while we're up in JP's part of the country in South on his show, and as the theme for the night was smuggling, we thought that there'd be no better place to record the show than the Flough, which, for anyone who knows the area, is near to Fanny Wiley's Bridge, right on the border. Now, this location is a traditional rambling house in exact detail, with a kitchen, open fire and lower room where you get the tea and plenty of home-cooked cake, bread and buns. The Flough is run by a hard-working committee from around the area who put on a show during the summer which replicates an American wake of years ago, and I can guarantee it's one of the best night's crack you'll ever have. While all the necessities of life were cheap and abundant, the gentry of the west and southwest coast depended for rum, claret, Spanish wine, snuff, socks, stockings, cambric, French shoes and gloves, laces, dried fruits and other luxurious items on the smugglers that abounded at the time.
Now, you might think that this piece of news came from Irish or British newspaper writings about smuggling in Ireland. In fact, it was about smuggling in Ireland, but published in the New York Times of February 1889.
The Annesley Revenue Cutter and Lough Swilly Revenue Barge have captured and carried into Londonderry the 26th Ultimo, a fine smuggling cutter, 126 tons burthen, called the Dover, with a cargo of tobacco valued at 7,000 after a 20-hour chase off in his own head.
This was a massive haul of tobacco, considering that this was published in the Caledonian Mercury. Now, that was a newspaper at Edinburgh, Scotland. Thursday, October the 9th, 1806. The 26th Ultimo being the 26th of September, 1806.
Now, anywhere in the world where there has been a land boundary, where something could be got cheaper on one or the other sides, has experienced smuggling, right up to the present day, where it's an opportunity to make millions for well-organised gangs carrying arms, ammunition, drugs, or indeed any type of contraband that can make them a profit by taking across a frontier.
These activities are looked upon by the authorities and by most people as a dangerous and highly illegal activity, punishable by hefty fines if the perpetrators are caught. Smuggling nowadays has also led to much misery and death, even among the smuggling gangs themselves.
It has to be said at the outset that many establishment figures were totally opposed to smuggling, as the following extract from the Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter vividly states. Although probably its main aim may well have been the root cause of smuggling in the first instance, the heading was the crime of partition and its evil consequences, and it was by the Lord Bishop of Clogher, Most Reverend Dr. Eugene O'Callaghan. And it goes, smuggling is one of the dire consequences arising from the mutilation of our country and the unnatural border which has cut our diocese in twain. The moral evils are deplorable. Some people appear to live for this illegal traffic. Little heed is paid to the virtue of truth, and perjury is on the increase. Our secular judges complain of the want of truth and the lamentable disregard for the sacredness of an oath.
Another member of the clergy, Bishop Farn of the Diocese of Derry, being aware that children are being used for smuggling purposes, asked in 1942, what hope can we have for the future if even at an impressionable age they, the children, are trained in lying and deceit?
Now, nevertheless, despite what the establishment had to say, for many residents on both sides of the Irish border, smuggling was almost a matter of survival due to the cost of essential clothing or foodstuffs being prohibitive, or even the essentials being unavailable. The Fermanagh train on a Friday became known as the Sugar Train, and in most cases there were many skinny young women arrived in Bundoran or Buncrana only to return that evening in a heavily pregnant state.
Just to give a brief example of what was smuggled into Northern Ireland during the years of World War II. Butter, eggs, meat, cheese, bacon, jam, chocolate, cigarettes and lighters whereas in the other direction went flour, tea, rice and paraffin oil.
Now, the British authorities also accepted smuggling as a lucrative, congenial and a successful trade, and that smuggling was almost a necessary part and parcel of life and a necessity for both sides of the border. This, of course, would be denied at every opportunity, but there are too many occasions when it was obvious that authorities on both sides of the border had at the very least a not very overly officious attitude to smuggling.
The fact that the Anishinaabe Peninsula was effectively cut off from the rest of the then free state and its main shopping city would have in normal circumstances been Derry City, and likewise Anishinaabe been Derry's hinterland, was an economic disaster for both.
However, the Irish being a resourceful lot put the territorial division to their advantage, and that they developed a two-way traffic and what some might call contraband, and others the necessities of life, while still more looked upon smuggling as a handy method of making a good living.
They then evolved in this area. In fact, it was down by the Tuir Road, cows that could have qualified for Olympic gold medals in swimming, going back and forward across the Foy.
Now, sheep and pigs became multinational and almost multilingual as well, as they made across the border half a dozen times in a day, drawing down a good government subsidy each time, the famous transit van being the choice mode of transportation in later years.
Butter and alcohol were both choice products for smuggling, whereas in the Second World War, these products went north, and now the compass has reversed from the 1960 onwards.
It must be said, however, that following World War II, the authorities tightened up on smuggling, thus causing the population to fall back on all the ingenuity that us Irish are world famous for.
A well-related story is about a man who crossed the Calais border every day on his journey from Derry. The customs began to get suspicious of him, and one day hit him with an unexpected spot check. All they found was that the saddlebag of the bike was full of what appeared to be sand. This went on for a number of occasions, and the revenue had the sand analysed by chemists in Dublin. And it was sand, and only pure sand. After the war, a custom official asked the bicycle owner, "What were you smuggling?" As he knew that something was going on, but they could never figure it out. So says the custom official, "What was special about the sand?" "Nothing," says the bicycle man. "I was smuggling bikes." The standard question asked by a custom official at the border was, "Have you any dutiable goods on board?" This was a question similar to, "Have you stopped beating your wife?" As an answer in the negative meant that if the official found dutiable goods on you, you were for the high jump. Now, if you were cheeky enough and asked what dutiable goods were, you could be in for a long wait, as the famous book on what was dutiable. Well, if it was an inch thick, it was a foot thick. There was also a strong rumour that in this index book, the B's ended with butter and the C's began with contraceptives.
Now, sometimes the health of the future recipient of smuggled goods came well down the list of a smuggler's priority. For example, there was a man suspected of smuggling, but he could never be caught, as the only thing he ever crossed the border with was a mere spreader full of cow dung. Well, his demise, however, came one day when a brave customs official decided to have the manure checked, and only to find that it, the manure, was the first layer of what was in fact a load of butter under a plastic cover that didn't offer too much protection from the smelly stuff above.
Sometimes there had been a standoff between the revenue and a cross-border traveller. For example, one night two men coming from the pictures in Derry bought a cooked chicken to eat when they reached their destination at Bridgend. On arriving at the custom post, the guardian of the state's livestock decided that the cooked chicken was either staying in Northern Ireland or been seized in the name of the law. However, our brave criminals decided that they were having none of this and sat and ate the chicken, and then proceeded to drive across the border for some refreshments.
Mind you, not all the sellers of potential contraband in the Republic were entirely honest either. It was often rumoured that many a vendor of eggs and butter, etc., would inform the customs of the arrival of said contraband. And it was seized, the original vendor could purchase the eggs and butter back from the customs at 20% of the original price.
On the topic of butter, Spare a thought for the poor woman who undertook to smuggle 6 pounds of butter from a town in Donegal back to Derry City. It was in fact a smuggling operation for every neighbour she had. She bought the butter in good faith, with its nice Irish creamery butter wrapping paper surrounding each pound, and successfully got back to Derry without a problem, or so she thought. On opening the package of butter, what did the poor intrepid smuggler find? Each pound of butter was in fact a pound of poundage, or mashed potatoes as was related. That it was bad poundage at that, and not even a pound weight.
As was mentioned earlier, the transit van was a transport of choice, but that was in later years. Two of the best vehicles would have been the Morris Oxford and Austin Cambridge, mainly because they had good strong springs in the back seat, which also gave a lot of space. You could have even placed at least a dozen sets of back shock absorbers for a Ford Anglia 105E in the space in the back seat alone.
Now, returning to the Bishop's pastoral about smuggling that we mentioned earlier, this could raise a theological question of great importance if it were to be put to an expert.
Now, let us explain. Without exception, almost every young boy going forward for his first Holy Communion was taken to Derry, in fact a certain shop in Waterloo Street, and he'd been wearing the oldest, roughest shoes and clothes imaginable. However, by the time he left Waterloo Street, he would have been a whole toff, with a new shirt and tie, new navy blue suit, shoes and socks, his old duds or clothes going to the nearest bin. Only an old overcoat and a scuffing of dust in the shoes took away from his sartorial splendour. In fact, the holy medal and badge he wore at his first communion or confirmation was purchased in Waterloo Street as well. I have no idea whether they would have been dutiful goods or not.
Did every boy receiving his first holy communion or confirmation do so in a state of grace or in mortal or venial sin?
Just in case anyone thinks that this area was the only one that raised the ire of the customs officials, let me relate a story that I got from a retired customs officer who worked for most of his life at Dublin's Port and Docks. When this particular officer was of a sort of a relaxed type of demeanour, his working partner was as sharp as a lance when it came to questioning people coming off across Channel Ferry. On one occasion, and bear in mind this was Ireland of the 1960s, a smartly dressed woman arrived at the customs counter with her suitcase and a round carved vase type container. After giving her suitcase his usual strict examination, the sharp customs officer turned his attention to the wooden vase, which he opened and began to inspect its contents, which resembled a form of cigarette ash. After sniffing and running the contents through his hands, he demanded to know from the woman what exactly this unusual material was, and what was it going to be used for. Apparently, without batting an eyelid, the woman looked the customs officer straight in the eyes and stated loudly enough for everyone within a reasonable distance to hear, "It's me husband, and while he gave me enough trouble in life, I never thought he would cause me bother in death." Apparently this episode cured that particular customs officer of being too inquisitive into people's belongings in the future.
Just to give a few small examples of why people smuggled. Firstly, bear in mind that a pound sterling and an Irish pound were of equal value, so there were no exchange rate differentials. So this meant that when paying for an item in Northern Ireland with an Irish note, you paid the price marked in the item. Your problem with the difference in prices obviously came when you arrived at the border. Just a few examples to show what you could save between Northern Ireland and the Republic. At a time, a pound of butter was a full pound sterling cheaper in the north. Thus, if you smuggled out a 28-pound flat pack of butter, you made £28 profit. This was when a tradesman was earning about £15 to £20 for a full week's wages. A bottle of whisky was a pound cheaper in the north compared to the south. For someone with a cafe, a 5-gallon drum of deep fat cooking oil was £5 cheaper in the north. It is only in recent years that petrol has become cheaper in the Republic. Just as cars from the south queued for ages to get petrol in the north, the opposite is happening just now.
On the other hand, all tobacco such as pipe, roll-ups and packets of cigarettes were considered to be cheaper in the Republic. This would of course raise a reasonable question whether partition was a good or bad thing for our border dwellers.
There are many stories about women being left standing in the heat while butter melted from its hiding place in a good wide pair of bloomers. Many a dozen eggs were broken as a custom official patted someone down a little too heavily, mainly on purpose. It was a game of cat and mouse, all right,
And to finish up, while we have only touched on the subject, and I know that for certain, we hope that our audience will have plenty of stories to tell, along with a song or two and a bit of music as the night goes on.
I can do a recitation. What was written by Mr. Tom Malloy, a poet of no mean standing, that used to live in the village of Burnfoot. He and his brother had a pub between them, and Malloy made some poems that were James. It would be a sin if ever they would sink into oblivion and be forgotten about. Now this is one of Tom Malloy's poems. It's entitled The Free State Farmer. I am a Free State farmer. I come from my show. My farm is not very large. Of bank books I have none. I toil along from day to day. I do the best I can. I sell my butter and my eggs like any old man. Now, dairy is my market town, for there I get my meat, my tea, my sugar and my bread, my parings and pig's feet. Some time ago, my clothes were worn. I went into Derry town and I left my measure for a suit. The tailor took it down. He said, call back in 3 weeks' time and ready it will be. So I paddled off along the road to the state. You see, it's free. My wife and I, we talked things over. We talked day by day, about how we get my suit across, no duty for to pay. Well, the day came round, I went to town, I went to get my clothes. Says I, I'll do these customers. I'll do it to their nose. I'll throw these toe-nose rags away, and I'll dress up like a tough. So with my parcel under my arm, to the station, I set off. I felt a wee bit guilty as I walked down the Strand, for I thought all hands would look at me. I was a frightened man. But I picked an empty carriage, for I had to be alone, to smuggle out a suit of clothes, for they rolled any show. The train steamed out past Pennyburn. I started to undress. The old coat went out the window, likewise my pants and vest. But when I opened up my parcel, to my horror, I did find the tiller had made some mistake. The pants were left behind. Oh, woe is me. The game is all up now. The shivering it came over me and the sweat ran down my brow. I looked a picture of distress, naked and alone, steaming at 30 miles an hour to dear old Annie Shaw. Well, the train pulled up at Gaelic Road. Clothesline hung nearby and a large pair of ladies' knickers there flew high into the sky. I knocked out them, pulled them on. They filled me to a T. Says I to myself, a +4 suit just makes a man of me. The customer saluted me. He thought I was a swell. But the wife said, damn near murdered me before I had time to tell. Oh, never again. No, never again. Well, I get out me alone, just smuggling into a suit of clothes to deal with old Annie Shaw.
There's an Inishowen country one who visited on one occasion by a number of American Marines who were stationed in Derry during the war. On looking round the yard, one of them noticed a particularly fine and well fed turkey, and he said to the woman, "Look here, that is a prime bird. If you deliver that to our mess ready for the table, I will make it worth your while." And he named it some far in excess of the local price. Knowing that permission could not be obtained to export the bird, the woman decided not to miss the opportunity of selling it at the tall figure offered by the Yankee. Accordingly, she without delay dressed the bird in her baby's clothes, complete with bonnet and shawl, and headed for Derry, nursing her precious burden. On arrival at the border, the customs official boarded the train and inquired of the passengers had they anything to declare. Not a hint of any shown woman, but what do you see here in my arms? Looking tenderly at her baby, which safely crossed the frontier into Northern Ireland.
There was a man down the Tuer Road, and he had a cow, and he said he wouldn't sell her for love nor money, because when he would be smuggling cattle into the north, he put the cow onto the foil and the rest of them followed her, and she took them up and out in the far side. There was another boy down there, and he had a dog, and he could take the cattle up as far as Muff and put them down what they call Cannons' Lane, down under the back shore. And he walked up to what was Mickey Barr's shop up there where the road comes up out of Kilmore, and met the dog with the cattle up there. There was a fortune to be made.
Well, I grew up in the border area as well. I'd say everybody here knows where Calais is. And I remember, right, late 50s and through the 60s. And we never thought on it as smuggling. Because as in the area here at Muff, and most of the border crossings, you'll all agree, they're all very remote areas from many towns. Our closest big town would have been Letterkenny, so everything we had, we depended on Derry for. And that was for education, jobs, work, health, everything came across the border. Our house would have been a great house for discussing these matters as well. I mean, we had customs on the main routes and customs patrols on the by roads, with the sole aim of collecting revenue for a government in Dublin. And it was always pointed out, particularly in our particular area, that there was very little revenue being spent back in the locality where they were getting this from. And I always remember that my mother perked up one day when she was reading her Irish Press, as it was then, and the Irish government were paying a subsidy of 2 million to the Northern government to sell their Kerrygold butter. So they were paying the subs, and then we were going to Derry buying Kerrygold butter, and with the risk of having it seized. Needless to say, there was very little seized from our shopping expeditions, because there was little by roads as there would be in Muff here, but it was always through the fields. And that's where an awful lot of we went shopping to Derry, we're in Wellingtons. Because that's how we came home, just over clay, burning up through the fields. Now, regarding the customs men themselves, they were coming in, you know, from southern parts. People tend to be more wary of customs men than they would be of guards. Because, you know, essentially the guards weren't there to do you any harm, they weren't to take anything from you. But the customs men were treated at a different level. Now, it has to be said, there were houses they didn't go into. But they were, I have to say, they're always welcome in our house, and more often than enough, there's two or three in a couple of nights a week, you know. And we were always thought of a good house to go for the crack. Of course, it was. It was the easiest way we could keep an eye on them. I have a little extract here. It refers to the Boundary Commission. The name of the Boundary Commission was the Feetham Boundary Commission. And I have a little extract here. This is in 1925 from the Chronicles of Donegal. Border Commission proposal caused uproar in Donegal. The Feetham Boundary Commission was a joint British-Irish initiative set up to determine the boundary parameters of the six counties following the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty. Orange Order leaders in Northern Ireland made several speeches recommending the incorporation of East Donegal and part of County Monaghan into the northern six counties. Shortly before the proposals were to be announced officially, the Irish government's appointee on the commission, Owen McNeill, offered his resignation. This led to widespread fears that Donegal was indeed to be divided. A leaked source indicated that all of Inishowen, as well as St Johnson, Carrigan area, was to be conceded to the six counties, whilst part of Nationalist Fermanagh was to be incorporated into Donegal. There was widespread opposition to the plan, and a large turnout at a Ballybuffet meeting united Donegal politicians in opposition to the proposals. Eventually, following intensive government contacts, proposals were scuppered, and the border remained
as it had been since the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921, which had ended the War of Independence. Among the speculation at the time was that five parishes of Kilray, Manor Conyngham, Raphoe, All Saints, Newton Conyngham, and Tabourne, St. Johnson, were to be incorporated into the six counties, while areas of South Armagh and Fermanagh were to be transferred to the Free State jurisdiction. Now, when they're talking about East Donegal, they're actually talking about that entire area that we were known as the Lagan Valley, arguably the most fertile piece of ground anywhere in this country. There was a lot of jockeying and horse trading to establish that boundary. And that's basically what happened, that the boundary ended up where it was. However, in the Calais area, the area we anybody would travel at up to a few years ago would have noticed the building in the middle of the road there, Kildrum Customs. Now, that Kildrum Customs is actually outside its area that it claims to be. It's actually in the townland of Altahaderry. And the story is, in the Calais area, when they first established the border line, the customs point itself was indeed in the townland of Kildrum. It's about 400 metres towards Letterkenny, if you like, from the border. I suppose subsequently they discovered then that they were too far back and they moved the border post to where it is now. Now, whether they didn't have the paint or the signage to change anything else, they kept the sign saying Kildrum Customs, and that's what remained until it was eventually taken away. But it just goes to show how close they were running it at the time, that those few yards didn't make the difference.
One of the reasons why the Treaty of 1921 was accepted, when people were debating would we accept or would we not, was the fact that there was going to be a boundary commission. And then people thought that this commission would be on the side of the Republic and that we would gain more than we're going to lose. And discussions went on, as Desi said, up until about 1925 or 26. But eventually the word leaked out that Donegal was actually going to lose quite a lot. And in fact, the border, in the case of the Mobile Road, was to start about a halfway point between Quigley's Point and Muff. So we think we're badly off, but in fact we could have been much worse. It could have started further towards Malinhead, if you like.
There was a man that used to smuggle pigs in. And it was a fellow from Muff, worked up at Campbell's at the border, just right on the border. It was nearly between the two customs huts, you know. And you would have had the Northern Ireland customs and the Free State customs. But anyway, he knew this boy was coming up with the pigs anyway. And custom men were out in the road and he knew your man was going to get caught and what was he going to do. So he let out Campbell's pigs and he got them hunted down over the border anyway when he got a chance, you see. So a while later, he ran about looking for the pigs and said, "Did you see any pigs going down there, boys?" "No, no pigs." So round the back shore road and up the Craig Road and all over the place looking for these pigs. But back down Muff Street anyway, down Springfield Gate, your man let his pigs out of the stone, he said, to the transit van. He come hunting them up over the border and the custom men standing laughing at him and the sweat running off him. And little did they know that it was a load of pigs that were been smuggled, you know.
I saw the last days of the Loughswilly Railway and my sisters, who are older than I am, they would have travelled up and down to work in Derry. They had some incredibly funny stories about the antics of one particular case I remember was the one of their friends smuggling a pair of corsets up their jumper and being caught at the border at Bridge End. They used to have what was called a lady searcher who really I think took the ladies apart. You were taken in, which was very embarrassing anyway, and she was caught with her corsets. But it was a big thing on the trains, especially on the days of the Loughswilly Railway at the border post at Bridge End. You know, both ways.